Hello, and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Rania Batrice, a non-resident fellow at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Today is Thursday, March 21st, and I'm delighted to be here with Ryan Grimm. Ryan is a well-established author and journalist. He's the host of the podcast Deconstructed, a political commentator on Breaking Points, and co-founder of Strong Arm Press, an independent progressive publishing house. He's also the Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. And for a very long time, I've appreciated Ryan for his commitment to the importance of independent journalism and the way the mainstream media is going these days. It's more important than ever. So we're going to talk about not just the dangers of inaccurate reporting in the mainstream media, but also how it shines a bright, shining light on the need and the importance of independent journalism, something obviously Ryan is intimately aware of and has lots of experience with. And if you tuned into my last episode, you heard an incredibly important conversation with Crystal Ball that was based in large part on Ryan and his incredible colleagues' investigative journalism regarding the gross negligence and misinformation out of the New York Times. And if you missed that episode, we'll drop the link into the show notes. Please check it out. Ryan, we're just going to jump in. As long as I've known you, you've had a very clear mission in reporting, not just accurately, but also in a nuanced way that centers the truth, which seems like something that should be integral with media, but, you know, not cannot be taken for granted. So even when it's hard, even when it, I can only assume, makes your life more difficult, and we're watching this genocide unfold right before our eyes, forced starvation, brink of famine. We're seeing all this, these reports out of several humanitarian organizations, including the UN. And your compass toward the truth and what's really happening is imperative, which feels like an understatement, but here we are. So we're going to just jump right in into the important work you've been doing. And I'm going to start with this first question. You have a weekly podcast, as I mentioned, called Deconstructed, that, quote, unpacks the most consequential news events of the week while challenging the mainstream media's tired takes, which, gosh, that's such a good descriptor. You also have a newsletter with The Intercept called Politics with Ryan Grimm, which we'll link in the show notes as well. And in your podcast, newsletter, and just your reporting overall, you've continued to speak on the horrendous conditions in Gaza and Israel's just genocidal actions. I'm just going to say it. And in January, you published your newsletter, a piece called CNN and the IDF Censor. So we're going to start here. You share that every CNN journalist covering Israel and Palestine has to submit their work for review by the news organization's bureau in Jerusalem prior to publication under the longstanding CNN policy. So I want you to just talk a little bit about what that means, that CNN's Jerusalem Bureau reviews all the reporting on Israel-Palestine before it goes out. Do you happen to know what that review entails? And can you talk about this arrangement, which I feel like I have to point out, this is transparent. It wasn't transparent before you reported it. So that's an really important point. And what do you think that means for the quality, integrity of the reporting that comes out of it?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thanks for the kind words. You're right. The style, the approach that The Intercept takes does make a lot of people upset. But at the same time, we're still here, and there's an entire kind of readership around the world that we've found has really rallied to it. So that part is extraordinarily heartening. On this particular piece, which was based on a story that Dan Bogoslaw did for us. He flagged this new process, which were old but new, which they're now calling kind of second eyes, which on the one hand makes some intuitive sense. Like, you're going to write about this country, you know, make sure that the bureau in that country has a chance to run through it. Now, the immediate thing people might notice is, what about the Gaza Bureau? Like, why aren't things running through the Gaza Bureau? And then you get to, Israel's refusal to allow kind of Western reporters in, but also Western media's kind of inability to link up or unwillingness to link up with the hundreds of freelance reporters that would be available, who are already in Gaza, and could have set up over the years, Gaza bureaus. So it's, the first thing you notice is that there's a Jerusalem bureau, but not a Gaza bureau. Because if the work had to go through both of them, you could imagine you might get an interesting kind of product out of that. You'd have a push and pull between the two. Now, the Jerusalem bureau puts pressure on the journalism in kind of multiple ways. And you don't need to get nefarious and conspiratorial about it. On the one hand, these are reporters who are embedded, in Israeli society. And so, they're going to be, they're kind of bathed in the attitudes that are common around the country of Israel at the moment. And anybody can look at polling and see that you find some extraordinarily trivial percentage of Israelis will say that what Israel is doing in Gaza is too much. Like, you either find 90%+ of people saying it's an appropriate level of force that's being deployed, or actually it's too little. Like, there ought to be, there's too much restraint being shown by the IDF. So there's that baseline level of unconscious bias that's going to work its way into the reporting. But also then there's the very nature of bureau reporting, which requires access to officials. And that access comes from, the happiness with which some of these, politicians or newsmakers are going to have with the reporting that's coming out. That's before you even get to the military notion of an actual censor that the Israeli government arrogates to itself the ability to actually censor journalism. And so a story that is reported in Atlanta that gets then routed to Jerusalem then is subject to military censors. Now, we're told that doesn't happen a lot, because you can imagine that most stories are not, well, a military, an IDF censor is not going to object to most coverage that's coming off CNN. They're yeah. fine with that. They're just gonna, oh, yep, that looks good. Wave that right through. A lot of it is not, remotely within the realm of controversial that they would look at. But if it was, it is then subject to the censor. The other thing it does is it slows down reporting, and it also dissuades editors and journalists from doing stories that they don't want to get hung up for days. So you just decide not to do this. Well, we could do this, and maybe we could get it through both the bureau and the censor, but it's probably going to take 3 days, and by then the story's done. So let's focus our energy somewhere else. And that is just a normal human reaction that a worker would have to the constraints that are being put in front of them. And that's what makes that's what makes those types of systems so effective, is that you don't want the censors to have to get the red pen out and rewrite copy. Like, that's a last resort for a successful, sophisticated censorship operation. What you want to do is put obstacles in place and put biases in place that make it so the entire construct of the reporting just produces what you want without you having to get involved in it. That's kind of the genius of a lot of the Western system compared to, say, an old Soviet system. Although the Soviet systems, at their most effective, would be the ones that would send out signals like, here are the things you can't say. Everybody would just know you can't mention Trotsky. By a certain point, no censor had to cut Trotsky's name out of a newspaper, because it just wasn't going to appear. Just everybody knew you don't mention that guy unless it's in a screed about how he's responsible for the grain harvest, being short.
But that's the success too, right? Exactly. I mean, this is, to your point, this is where they have been wildly successful. And I just will point out a couple of things. One, they've been wildly successful for a very long time.
Yes.
You know, this feels more damning and disgusting, my words, obviously, because of what we're watching happen. But this is, they have this level of success because it's not new, because they've put those roadblocks, to your point, in place for a very long time, and they've had success doing it. And the other thing I just want to flag that you mentioned, that was kind of discussed for a while, but there's, understandably, there's so much happening, things stop right. getting talked about. So one of the things you said that I want to just put a pin in, or not a pin in, but a flag on, whatever you want to call it, is there's still, you know, the Israeli government is not allowing Western right. media into Gaza. So that is, again, it's not new, but we're not hearing it being discussed as much because there's so many other atrocities to right. be talking about.
It gets washed away in this river of blood. There was, I think it was a CBS News reporter that pressed the White House on this a couple days ago, but it was a rare moment where the Western press, you know, stuck up for this issue and said, you know, what are you doing to try to pressure, or are you trying to pressure the IDF to allow Western journalists into Gaza? And got a complete non-answer, like not even a, you know, when it comes to humanitarian aid, the answer you'll get is, you know, we encourage Israel to do more, and we believe right. that they can do more, and we just wish they would. And it's such a shame that they're not.
Yeah.
When it came to this, they didn't even say that they were pressuring. They didn't even say that it would be good. They just said, well, you know, we support, I think the answer was like, obviously we support the free press, and the president spoke to the value of the free press just recently. So, and then just moved on.
Glossed over it. Yeah.
But you can imagine how fundamentally the character of the coverage would change if you had Western reporters who were inside Gaza and could, just instantly puncture so many of the lies that are coming out of the IDF, you know, have grown so inflated that just a little tiny pinprick from a Western reporter would pop them. You saw it play out with Alon Levy and the MP in Britain, is her name Meeks, I believe. Where she had just been to the border and been at the scene of the crime where they're not allowing the humanitarian aid. So she watched it with her own eyes. And so he goes on Twitter and says the same thing that Israeli spokespeople have been saying for weeks, which is this absolutely incredible claim that there are no restrictions on aid getting into Gaza. Like, that's the level of the claim that they're making, not the kind of sophisticated propaganda of Hamas is stealing all the food, or it's the UN.
Yeah.
UN is actually the failing problem.
Yeah, the UN is the problem. Right, right.
But,
these wonderful.
There are no restrictions.
Little,
there are no restrictions of aid getting in. And she, because she had just been there, had the credibility and the knowledge to say, that's not true. But if you're saying it's true, then great. I'm going to tell Cameron that you have said there are no restrictions on aid getting in, and we'll be sending trucks to the crossing. With your signature as on approving this happening. And then it seems like his internal enemies used that to like boot him out of his job, which is a whole different story.
Right.
But it shows how just a tiny, tiny bit of knowledge about what's going on, you know, and the entire Jenga falls apart.
I mean, this is exactly what we're talking about, right? It's partially access, right, which they are very clearly blocking, and it's partially, okay, once you have access, what do you do with it? I do want to talk a little bit about that contrast. So in contrast with CNN, for example, and obviously we're picking on CNN, but there's many others. I just want to talk a bit about the role of independent media in covering this genocide, and getting a little bit into the weeds of, can you define for us what the independence means? What is independent media, and what do you see independent media's role specifically on reporting in Gaza?
I, Which one should we take first? I mean, independent media is interesting because one of the problems that we've started to see develop with independent media has been audience capture. You are no longer corporate funded, or you're no longer billionaire funded, but now that your supporters who have, you know, pre-baked ideas around XYZ or issue are giving you X amount of money a month, and you're now kind of dependent, literally dependent on those contributions. And if you're aware of what their, you know, politics are, that can cause you problems about whether you can independently report on things. Now, if you do, you still can. It just means, you know, you're going to take a hit. And you've seen, you know, what you've actually seen with some independent journalists who picked up large kind of right-wing audiences because they were not necessarily because they themselves were right-wing, but they were hitting a lot of the right-wing notes on censorship, on, you know, anti-woke stuff, that kind of thing. So they created this kind of uneasy alliance with their audience that after October 7th blew up because they were being extremely critical of what Israel was doing in response to that. And as a result, we're losing, you know, huge numbers of subscribers. Now, Glenn Greenwald has talked publicly about this, and he has enough of a base of support that he's fine. Like it's not going to influence what he says, which also allows him then to speak openly about it. And he has said that, you know, after October 7th, you know, he's seen a huge decrease, you know, in his number of like subscribers, which if he were smaller, you know, just as a person who's running, trying to make a living, has to like influence you at some level. Now he's so large that he can take a 20% hit, 30-50% hit even, and he's still fine. But so that's something that independent media is still working out. What I think is the answer to that is to, you know, inculcate in your readership the love of disagreement, to make it a project of seeking and searching rather than being, you know, locked in on one particular in one particular place. On Wednesday mornings, I do this show Counterpoints, which is part of the Breaking Points Network. We have a left-wing host. I'm the left-wing host. And then we have a right-wing host as well. And we don't really argue a ton. We just kind of each give our perspective on whatever the thing is that we're talking about. And that allows this huge audience to disagree with us at all the time. Because you're always going to disagree with somebody, but they're still supporting right. The idea of an independent media and the value of the independent media is that there are real problems with this institutional corporate structure, which is going to have top-down dictates that if you were, you can be a tremendous reporter at CNN, you're going to, or the New York Times, even worse so sometimes. You're not necessarily going to be able to get the stories that you have into print. I am consistently kind of beating people in the industry to stories. And I have come to the realization that that's not because I'm more talented than them. Like, there are a lot of really talented journalists at all of these different institutions. But when I get a story, I can just publish it.
Right.
And that is an
advantage.
Don't
have all the all the red tape and all the bureaucracy. And I mean, and I saw a it's not a new one, but I saw it again recently and I was like, yeah, but I saw this meme. I won't repeat the expletive, but it said something like the role of the journalist is to look outside and see if it's raining, not argue about if it's raining or not, or you know what I mean? That's kind of you know, to me is sort of what's been missing in the mainstream media is it everything is about, you know, the sexy headline or what's going to get more clicks or what's get not. It's not about reporting just what's happening. It's about there's an angle. And to your point, yeah, you know, whether it's donors or funders or whatever it is. And, you know, we can all understand where that comes from, but the disservice that it does to us as a whole, as a society, as a community is so, it can be so damaging. And actually I want to lead us into this next question. This is kind of a nice little segue. I mentioned a couple minutes ago, just your incredibly important report on the New York Times story, and that Hamas committed systematic widespread sexual violence during the October 7th attacks. We did a whole podcast, like I said, with Crystal in the last episode, and I'll drop that show link. But I don't want you to necessarily go over every detail here because your reporting is extensive, and we will drop those links in again. But I just want to ask you kind of more granularly, why did you decide to focus on this story? It's obviously incredibly explosive. As I mentioned before, y'all have targets on your backs in ways that that tend to come when you're kind of speaking truth to power, to the Goliaths or whatever you want to call them. But what about the story and the New York Times approach to it that made you think this is something I absolutely have to dig into, you and your team, obviously, and lay bare the failings of the Times reporting and set the record straight? You know what I mean? Right. And the importance of what y'all do day to day. Can you just talk about that impact in your reporting on this story?
Yeah. And, you know, between us and everybody listening here, you know, I will admit that this is not the kind of story that I'm eager and, you know, like itching to go down.
Yeah.
Like for the most obvious reasons anybody could easily put their finger on. And so we were not remotely kind of the first in independent media to kind of start pressing on some of these claims that were being made about 10/7. And it was really the weight of the inconsistencies and contradictions and biases that kind of just almost forced our hand. Like one way I've always thought about, you know, what our role is in the media ecosystem is that if you feel uncomfortable or nervous about a story, but you also believe that the story is true, like that's our place. Like our job is to push through that and go there. Because if we believe something is true, but we run up against a wall of nervousness about it, and we shrink back and find something that's a little bit more comfortable, but still a good, interesting story, then we're not doing our job. Like we're not fulfilling the role that people have really kind of supported us to put that people depend on us for. Because if we're not doing it, then nobody else is doing it. And not to say that nobody else in independent media is doing it, but nobody else with our credibility, our ability to kind of bridge the mainstream media and the independent media, because of the work that Jeremy and I and others have done, you know, over the years, that has, you know, won the mainstream awards and you know, built up that mainstream credibility. It has bought us the ability to be heard in those spaces, which is, it turns out, extremely important. It's wrong. There ought not to be that hierarchy, that the hierarchy is upside down, that the news organization that really has no credibility is the New York Times based on its history of the last 20, 25 years. You can say all those things, but you also know that they're not true. Like that there is, that power is arbitrary and it is, and it is controlled, you know, currently by those mainstream institutions, the NPRs, the MSNBCs, the New York Times. And if you're not able to penetrate that bubble, you're not able to shape the public understanding of an issue, and you're not going to reach the lawmakers and the policymakers who are we're making these decisions. And so
right.
that's the kind of role that we are able to play. And we're also, pretty good at like doing the actual reporting, like going out and finding like new details.
I would say more than pretty good, but yes, I hear you.
So in that case, we're not just going to go in and kind of, aggregate, what the Israeli media has done and what, Mondo Weiss and Gray Zone and Electric Intifada and others had like already done. Like, we're going to try to find ways in that are adding to the question. We were able to do that with, in particular, finding this completely off the rails interview that Anat Schwartz gave in Hebrew to what turns out to be a really obscure podcast. And this is an interesting media thing. Like, it was a Channel 12 podcast, and Channel 12 is a huge corporate media outlet, very mainstream, very well watched, very highly watched. But the podcasts are an afterthought. And it's, imagine like, it's like NBC News, like imagine NBC Nightly News has a podcast. Like, NBC Nightly News has millions of viewers.
Yeah.
NBC Nightly News podcast might have 100 viewers. And so that's well produced and gets good guests. And so that's basically what that podcast was. And so because Anat Schwartz, who was a stringer, for the New York Times for a lot of these articles, did not have a background in journalism, she was, I think, much more revealing than a journalist would be about the process that led to it. And so, we took what she said in that podcast, then compared it to, what was in the article and what we also knew about events as they unfolded around that time.
Yeah. And I want to sort of dive a little bit more into something. I mean, it's partially exactly what you're talking about. It's what you were talking about a minute ago. I'm using this word scary, like some of these scary topics that, to your point, it's not like you're just itching to dive into it and make things and make your own life harder.
Yeah.
But it's really important, especially when you're talking about a historically trusted outlet like the New York Times. So in the same vein, you, in your reporting and, some of the other outlets that you've worked with, you have taken a focus, you've put a focus on AIPAC, and it's, we know they've been around for decades and decades, but their super PAC is pretty new. The United Democracy Project. And so you've really taken on this massive entity that any of us who've worked in this space in any capacity understand that once you do that, you find yourself on blacklists and the target of any number of different hate and all, target, blah, blah, blah. But I just want to, you specifically have kind of chosen this, right, which I thank you for, but it's not easy. And so I want to ask you, why do you think it's important to talk about AIPAC within our U.S. elections? What do you want people to understand through your reporting about their efforts and their impact on our elections?
Well, I think people now are starting to get a sense of how influential they are. But certainly when I wrote the book that came out in December, and spent the last couple of years off and on working on it, it draws heavily on the reporting that I've done over the last, 5-6 years. People didn't really have, any clue of how just, omnipresent they had become and were increasingly becoming. You'd have one-off articles here or there, but the way that they were just reshaping, what was possible in Democratic politics was a story that really wasn't, I don't think, being told. And it goes to, it's a similar version of what we were talking about with the CNN censor, that it really starts to work most effectively, the influence, when they don't have to actually engage. And so they're, right. And I'm sure you've experienced this yourself on campaigns, that there are a lot, like if an organization like AIPAC can come in to five or six races and drop $5 million each and influence those races, you know, they win some, they lose some. The other 50 races where they're facing a competitive primary sit up and take notice, and AIPAC then doesn't even have to spend in those races.
Right.
And can guide and influence policy anyway. And the way that a lot of these candidates, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, think about the question is just a very cynical, all right, what's the cost benefit here? All right, if I stand up for Palestinian rights here, the cost is potentially millions of dollars, you know, coming down on my head in this primary. And the benefit is unclear because there's no counter super PAC. There wasn't a coalition of groups that were able to put together several million dollars in independent funding. So it's not like zero, but there's no, you know, AIPAC for Palestinians or even AIPAC for Arab Americans is, you know, remotely able to compete on that level. So just from a cynical level, they're like, okay, well, there's over here. And then most of the voters who are going to be progressive and support Palestinian rights are going to support you anyway, because they're so used to this progressive, except for Palestine question. This is all pre October 7th. And I think the electoral calculations are changing amidst this genocide. But before October 7th, it's like, you know, voters and activists didn't really have much of another choice, you know, if they're on the left. Yeah. So that allows the candidate who's on the left to move very, you know, gingerly and gently to the right. And so you just have in a call that a consultant might say, you know what, just hurry up, put out a tweet. I stand with Israel. Apropos of nothing. Just, you know, just put it out there. And the less it makes sense in context for a candidate to be saying, just, I stand with Israel in a tweet. The more it shows the fealty, because it's like, you're willing to just kind of embarrass yourself by saying something out of nowhere. It doesn't even make sense. Right. And then share it with the people who are thinking about dropping a couple million dollars on you. And then when you're in Congress and somebody is circulating a letter that says, let's say, hey, Israel isn't allowing the vaccine to get into the West Bank or into Gaza. Shouldn't we allow that? The members of Congress are going to think twice before they sign that letter. Even the most anodyne, harmless, like, who could imagine everybody should have access to a vaccine being an offensive type of statement that's going to elicit hostility and money spent against you. But people understand that it is, because because the conversation has been so severely restricted that anything that is even neutral about Palestinians then raises alarms. Because it's like, wait a minute, you know, you're only supposed to say positive things about Israel and negative things about Palestinians. So if you're saying a neutral thing about Palestinians, does that mean that you actually harbor even deeper sympathies where you might actually genuinely support equal rights for Palestinians? And so what so many Democrats end up doing is just saying, you know what, I'm not touching it. Not touching it.
Yeah.
What's AIPAC's position? I'm on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it just like you pointed out, it is very similar to the, you know, the sort of CNN censorship, or, you know, it all goes hand in hand. And again, the genius of it, the efficacy of it, is all of these roadblocks. And you really can't, I mean, we saw it in California with Dave Min. Right. He's not wildly pro-Palestinian. Well, he said something about Netanyahu, you know, and regardless of how the vast majority of Jewish Americans feel, you know, it was just enough to it's not like he's some wildly pro-Palestinian individual. And I will just the I mean, like the yellows, Millers, and you know, all these wild things. And even there was a member of Congress who called out the racism, but did not call out AIPAC specifically. And so, to your point, it's the perfect example of this is a wildly racist tactic that they've used before against Black candidates too. And I'm gonna call it out because it's so gross, but I'm not gonna call them out by name because of that sort of instilled fear. And I will just mention, obviously, FMEP is a 501c3, and this is a very electoral conversation that FMEP has nothing to do with. These are my feelings and thoughts.
No, this is just analysis. No endorsements analysis. Here, one way
exactly.
or another.
Exactly, zero endorsements. No, but just so important to name that the tentacles sort of reach into all these different spaces, electoral spaces, media spaces, and it's just like you said, those roadblocks that are put into place very intentionally over many, many years to silence people, actually. And they have been wildly effective. I think people are waking up, and we've never had the pro justice equity side of things have never had the budget, to your point, that an AIPAC has had. But I do think that even people who haven't necessarily understood one way or another the history or what's going on are sort of waking up and having these kinds of conversations, which is obviously, it's not everything, but it's important. And I do want to, I'm kind of switching gears a little bit, but it's a nice through line into censorship. But after October 7th, we saw and have seen many attempts to censor and silence people speaking about the harms against Palestine and Palestinians, and people have been fired from their jobs, and teachers have been reported, and students have been suspended and sanctioned. And, you know, there's a chemical attack on a campus and they're not investigating the attackers. They're saying, oh, you were protesting without a permit or whatever, you know, whatever thing it was, you know, and then the sanctions by these administrations. And so on multiple campuses across the country, student groups, including Student Justice for Palestine, including Jewish Voice for Peace, they've faced suspensions and other repercussions. And I just want to hear your thoughts on this. It's kind of a little bit of a growing trend, backed by some in Congress on both sides of the aisle, of targeting academia and free speech for activism when it relates to Palestine and Palestinian rights and sovereignty. Or even just specifically against this genocide, and you know how that kind of relates to everything else we're talking about, broader censorship in academia. We can see this through line.
And I think some of it goes back to that, what we were talking about, that super constricted room for conversation. And so because the normal kind of expected, understood, polite conversation around the issue is 100%, you know, pro-Israeli and completely erase all everything relating to any indignities faced by Palestinians, because that's the general kind of accepted normal thing that goes on in universities and everywhere else, that things that are outside of that start to sound crazy. There was it was going around the other day that somebody quite prominent was calling the term occupation a blood libel, which is such a perfect example. The occupation is a fact. You can support the occupation. You can oppose the occupation. You cannot care about the occupation, but there is an occupation. Like, there's no question of the fact of the occupation. But because the conversation is so constricted, just saying normal, truthful things are made to sound controversial. And so you get somebody accused of a blood libel for saying the phrase occupation. I think it was actually Glazer. They were coming after Glazer for using the phrase occupation. Yeah. And so that's just a statement of a basic fact. If you make an opinionated claim that is to the left, and left, right doesn't really quite make sense on this, but let's call it left. you make an opinionated claim that's to the left of there being an occupation. Or let's say you get into the general fact that Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, et cetera, call this a system of apartheid. Mm-hmm. You're still talking facts. Like, just, you're not even in opinion territory at that point. These are facts. Right. Like, this is what the system is. Like, people have different rights based on their race or their ethnicity. Fact. Now you've already offended. Like, now you're in offensive territory. And you're still just stating basic facts. Now you call it, you know, a brutal apartheid regime. Now students are getting suspended. Professors are getting, you know, called into disciplinary boards or not saying anything at all because they, you know, are nervous about their adjunct positions, which, you know, something like 70% of professors no longer have, you know, tenure or even any tenure track. And so I think that those two things are related. And then because the conversation is so constricted, like normies who are having the conversation hear the word apartheid and they're the ones that sit on these disciplinary boards. And they're like, wow, that sounds anti-Semitic. And then because,
there's an effort to make everything anti-Semitic too, as we know. I mean, even changing the definitions.
Lobbying campaign to change the legal definition so that you could then discipline people for criticism of Israel under anti-bias, anti-bigotry educational statutes, like a very and a very top-down, sophisticated, well-financed campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, again, not new, ongoing. And I do have to just say, it's something I talk about often. It's not earth-shattering in any way, but just how damaging it is when you reduce anti-Semitism to these kinds of efforts and attempts. And because there's real hate, there's real anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. There's those things are very real. And when we continuously
I think I've seen it unfold on the right. Like, I think you see genuine anti-Semitism on the right now from people who think that they can get away with it because the entire concept is discredited by the perpetual linking of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. Like, so I don't think it's theoretical anymore that you can
absolutely
kind of defang the fight against anti-Semitism. I think we're actually seeing it unfold,
because you often see
people who are legitimately accused of actual anti-Semitism, where they're clearly being anti-Semitic, and they'll respond, you say that about everything, and their genuinely anti-Semitic supporters will say, you say that about everything,
and then they'll
carry on with actual straight up vile anti-Semitism.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Okay. We could have a whole conversation about that and Jonathan Glazer, but another conversation for another day. I want to talk a bit about leader Schumer, Chuck Schumer, who has provided some of the harshest criticism of Netanyahu that we've seen from the establishment yet. And he said, quote, Netanyahu's lost, he said a lot of things, it's like 45 minute speech or something, but he said that Netanyahu, quote, lost his way. We saw the back and forth, and we could spend an entire episode talking about the misinformation in his own speech from the Senate floor. But I just for now want to talk about Schumer calling out Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Smoltrich, and others, and actually calling for Israeli elections. And of course, we saw the back and forth with the White House from Netanyahu himself, of course, AIPAC. And we've seen a continuation of the White House leaking these stories about Biden's frustration with Netanyahu, of course, followed by zero actions or consequences. But I want your take on all of this. And once again, just your thoughts around how what you do in independent journalism in unpacking these kinds of situations where, despite, again, all the misinformation in his speech, I was still shocked and then have my own perspective on why he did it. But we won't go into that. Yeah. I want to hear your thoughts.
I think one there's two roles that we play there. One is the counterintuitive one of having the credibility to tell an audience how significant like that shift is. That, like you said, it's the, there's enormous amounts of misinformation, and you could go on it like, and you know, it's too, you could go too little, too late. It is also, as you said, the biggest break, you know, from an establishment Democratic figure, you know, with Netanyahu, and that signals something potentially serious down, you know, a real shift in the relationship between either the U.S. and Israel, Democratic Party, and Israel. And it's important to understand how significant that is. We, you know, we can also, as independent media, point out the ways that, you know, Schumer's policies himself, you know, nurtured and created Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, just on a very basic political economic level, that if you have two, if you have basically two competing visions, you know, inside Israeli politics, one is we don't ever need to compromise with the Palestinians. We can just continue to expand, build more settlements, manage the conflict, and eventually just annex all of this territory because we have unconditional, unlimited United States support. That's one camp. The other camp is no, you know, we ought to, you know, we share this land with millions of people, and we need to find a way to live together. That camp was beaten by the camp that said we don't need to make a compromise. And the way that they were able to argue that they didn't need to make a compromise is they could just point to the United States, unconditional, unlimited support. So it was people like Schumer who, you know, badly undermined, you know, Israeli forces that were, who, because like if you're an Israeli at that point, you're like, well, I'm going with these people who say that we don't have to make any compromises at all, and we can just keep building more settlements. That sounds better than what this guy's saying over here. The second that the U.S. puts any conditions on aids and puts any limits, then the Israeli camp that is saying, well, we have to compromise, is the correct one. Like you actually do. Like you don't have a choice. So so we can point all that out, but we can also say that you know, Schumer's speech marks a stark break. And you know, Netanyahu tried to address the Senate Democratic caucus this week, and was told no. The Republican caucus allowed him to speak. And John Fetterman, by the way, if you saw this, said he tried to get into
Mehdi Hassan called him a caricature at this point. And I mean, talk about massive, massive disappointment. But yes, I did see that, and I did want to throw things at the same time. Like, that's pretty, pretty incredible. I don't know what's going on there. Again, conversation for another day. But
the NRA is an interesting institution to think about in this context. You know, for decades, they had a very similar approach to AIPAC electorally, in that they were well organized in every single district. They had single issue voters. They had, you know, financial firepower, and they took scalps, to use a politically incorrect term. That if somebody bucked them, they would target them, and through that, and but only a couple times. Like, they only took out a couple members. But that struck fear into everybody else's heart. And because there wasn't yet a Bloomberg on the other side, there wasn't any money on the other side, it was okay, we've got these people who are super passionate about their guns over here. If I cross them, I will be beaten. And on the other side, there's really no, you know, there's nobody on the other side that is going
right.
to take me out as either a Democrat or a Republican if I'm, you know, too cozy with the NRA. The NRA decided that they were basically going to become a partisan Republican organization, and started going after, you know, swing district Democrats who in the past they would have supported. And that took, you know, multiple cycles, but you could see the process unfolding, and they eventually did become a full-on, you know, arm of the Republican Party. And yeah, just in a similar way to say Planned Parenthood, you know, used to be, you know, they endorsed Mitch McConnell in his first race, but then eventually became an arm of the Democratic Party. And what that meant for both the NRA and Planned Parenthood is that when Republicans were in power, the NRA had power and could implement policy. When Democrats were in power, Planned Parenthood had some power. But when their sponsors were in the minority, they were out. They were out of power. So AIPAC is now on its way toward becoming an arm of the Republican Party. How long that will take and what that looks like remains to be seen. But if they achieve their objective, which appears to be to knock out, you know, swing district Democrats and become like an arm of the Republican Party, the consequence is that when Democrats are in power, then AIPAC is out of power. So it's it's a self-defeating strategy. Like if I were their consultant, I would advise them against that. But they seem kind of hell bent, like that it seems an impulse that they can't resist.
They also, though, which I think obviously I know it's intentional, they also are very, very quick when Democrats do call them out to publish their list of Democrats that they donate to. You know what I mean? And so I do think they're very, I think you're exactly right. And I think they're trying to like straddle this line, which, and I love the NRA analogy. And in fact, I talk about that a lot too. And the choice issue, all the choice groups as well, not even just as they sort of like turn into more specifically partisan groups, but also the fact that you didn't talk about it until you talked about it, right? So it was like the third rail until all of a sudden it wasn't. And I do just have to name part of what makes it acceptable, less scary, more just easily the right thing to do is what you do, quite frankly, is the role of independent journalism where, okay, it's so scary to talk about the NRA, guns, choice, et cetera, until it's not, but we have to get there, right? So this like hedging a little bit at a time, you know, meanwhile, it's the biggest cause of death of children in this country are guns. I mean, not again, that's not what we're here to talk about, but like, you know, we didn't talk about it until we talked about it. So I do think that all of this comes back, you know, we kind of bring it full circle into the importance of what y'all are doing, and how that plays into just broader conversations in general. And it's not even because you're attempting to make this happen. It's just putting the truth out there in digestible ways for people to take, absorb, and understand, okay, this entity is actually trying to control my behavior. And if I stop and think about what that means, I don't agree with it. You know what I mean? Right. So I think this all kind of plays together in a way. And on this kind of last point, I just want to ask you one last question as we wrap this up. And again, it's just an extension of what we're talking about here. So we've seen the turmoil and what's just happening in the areas of investigative journalism, as we talked about at the top and we talk about often. And in parallel, what's happening in mainstream journalism has become more homogenized and consolidated. Again, you mentioned this too. And so we've been talking about this today and what's the role and what does it mean, especially in the context of Israel's ongoing invasion and genocide against the people in Gaza. I just want you to talk more broadly, real quick, as we wrap this up, what would it mean if independent investigative journalism no longer existed? What would the world look like, especially in the US, and what would those effects be?
I was actually talking to a New York Times reporter a little while ago about this question. And he was saying, who's left to check us? Like we've gotten so hegemonic that, you know, after the after their weapons of mass destruction catastrophe, they did some introspection and apologized and like went on a reform tour after Jason Blair, the fabulous that they had accidentally hired and had making stuff up for them. The editors there assigned articles, investigative articles, into how it happened. And those articles kind of resulted in the firings of some of the same editors that assigned those and that kind of self-reflective piece. That was happening in an environment where there was a more robust media. Now, since their caliphate catastrophe and this one, there's just a circling of the wagons where they feel, and I'm picking on the New York Times, but I think this applies broadly to all major institutions. Yeah. They feel like they can post their way through accountability. You know, that there isn't enough independent alternative kind of force to pressure them. I don't think they're right. I think they're misreading what's out there, but I do think that without independent media, then there's really no chance at accountability for these institutions. And what that looks like is scary, because then it's just the people who are leading the institutions, guided by their own self-preservation and whatever random biases that they happen to have, and that they have by the circumstances of having wound up in those positions. So without the checks and balances, basically, of an independent media, you wind up with a deeply sclerotic elite, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we're seeing it play out kind of in real time, which just, as we wrap this up, I just can't thank you enough for spending time with me today. Your dedication, obviously, I've had respect for many years, and just experience in, again, bringing the truth forward without an agenda, just a commitment to bringing it forward. It's been so important in general, but especially now in the past several months with your reporting on Gaza. And I just thank you. And I thank our listeners for tuning in to this episode of Occupied Thoughts. Please make sure to check out the FMEP website. It's www.fmep.org for resources related to this podcast and lots of other general content related to Palestine and Israel. And please make sure you are subscribed to this podcast. Stay up to date. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Spotify, and you can also watch a video version of our podcast, including this one, on YouTube. And with that, I'm Rania Batrice, signing off until the next episode of FMEP's Occupied Thoughts.